We love supporting and promoting the creators of musical theater throughout the world, and we would love to have your support as well. Go to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the Become a Patron button, because a supportive community is a strong community. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. Today we speak with someone who seems to be able to do it all. He's an accomplished performer, producer, writer, costume designer, photographer, and lover of dogs. My question is, what can't this man do? It gives me great pleasure to welcome to the show, James Rich. James, thank you for coming
on. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
No problem. So I always get to know who I'm speaking with, and the audience might not know you. So I always ask for a 30-second bio. So who is James in 30 seconds?
Oh, man, this is going to be a tough one for me. I'm a talker. But okay, here goes. James Rich is a free-spirited doggy dad. I love the colors green and brown, and my favorite guilty pleasures are homemade chocolate chip cookies, french fries, and pizza. I was born in Alabama, grew up in Connecticut, and moved to New York when I was 22 years old. I'm one of those people. I was born with a natural talent for sketching things, particularly fashion illustration, and I was groomed as a visual artist growing up. I dropped out of visual art school twice before I finally found the thing that makes me tick, which is live theater. My first professional theater job in New York was performing in a dinner theater production of Finian's Rainbow, which I attended the audition on a dare from a coworker, and I got cast in the show. I continued to get my feet wet performing for a few more years, and with very little formal training. Then I enrolled at Syracuse University and graduated with a BFA in musical theater. I moved back to New York, and after graduating, I carved out a quirky little eclectic career for myself. And in all those years that I've been doing theater professionally, I have never stopped sketching pictures. Wow. It is a form of self-therapy for me. I have even been able to capitalize on my art and design school training in the role of costume designer for a few theater productions. Another thing that I've kept up, and this kind of wraps into what we'll get into a little bit later, but another thing I've kept up through the years is writing. I have always been an avid journal writer from as far back as I can remember, before New York, before school in Boston, my whole life. And somewhere along the way, my affinity for journaling progressed to writing short stories. And in a very natural way, my short story writing became the impetus to write my 30 plus years passion project, which is a script for a musical called There Was a Boy, based on the life of Nat King Cole, the man behind the music. I know that was way more than 30 seconds, but that is my story and I am sticking with it.
I'll let it go.
Okay, awesome, awesome.
30 seconds, nah, we'll throw that out the window. Now, we'll get into the Nat King Cole musical in a minute, but I do always want to take it back. Were you always into musical theater growing up, or was that something you discovered a little bit later?
Okay. Well, sort of both. I mean, I was an animate, like I said, a natural gifted visual artist, and no one ever taught me to draw. It's just something that came to me as natural as walking and talking. So I was really pushed in that direction growing up. I wasn't forced or anything like that. It's just that I excelled in that area, and my family and people around me at school recognized my talent and they groomed me as a visual artist. But there was always music around me, whether it was, you know, the eclectic collection of albums in the basement of our house in Connecticut, or my mother singing in the church choir, or at school. When I was a kid, music class 2 to 3 days a week was a requirement. Now it's an elective if it's even offered at all, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
And then there was also TV. I spent, good Lord, I probably spent a lot of time in front of the TV like most kids. And I never missed, I'm about to date myself right now. I never missed an original episode of Carol Burnett's show. Sonny and Cher, Flip Wilson, Laughing, all those good shows from the 70s. And all those shows, they were billed as variety shows. But at their core, they were a series of skits strung together by and with songs. Mm-hmm. So in musical theater terms, I personally would define that as a musical theater review. So in that sense, I have always been into musical theater. And just like drawing pictures, I was born with a natural singing voice, just a natural ability to sing. No one ever taught me. It just, again, came as natural as walking and talking. But I was a painfully shy kid. So the thought of singing in public was not something that I ever even entertained, no pun intended. I fantasized about it, but for all the chocolate, pizza, and French fries in Connecticut, it just did not, I just did not have the courage to get up in front of people and perform. Yeah. Now, in the basement of our house in Connecticut, it was a whole different story. I mean, I spent hours and hours and hours drawing pictures and singing along with every album and that my parents had down there. Like I used to put on full shows by myself in the basement, just all the parts, dancing, everything. Some of my favorite records to sing along with were the Jackson 5, Aretha Franklin, Tom Jones, Sarah Vaughan, Nat King Cole. There were a lot of musical theater albums down there randomly. I don't know where they got them from because they weren't particularly people who went to the theater all the time.
Yeah.
But I sing along with those two. Babes in Arms, I remember. My Funny Valentine from there. Camelot, Raisin, based on A Raisin in the Sun. The Wiz, A Misbehavin', Sophisticated Ladies. And I loved watching movie musicals. Some of my favorites there are, Guys and Dolls, Pajama Game, Sweet Charity, West Side Story, The Sound of Music, Kiss Me Kate, On the Town, and anything that featured Gregory Hines, Fred Astaire, and Gene Kelly were at the top of my list. But again, the singing and performing pretty much ended in the basement at home. It didn't help that on top of that, that on top of being a shy kid, my brain has always moved a little quicker than I can talk. And so it caused me to stammer and stutter. Mm. And as a kid, that made me feel stupid. And so I felt really embarrassed, was just very quiet into myself a lot. But by excelling as a visual artist, that boosted my confidence and it gave me a better sense of self. And it was a good cover because it didn't require me to talk. Everybody could see how talented I was, which made me feel accepted and validated. So to wrap this all up, while I have always been into musical theaters and theatrically based stuff in the basement of our house, I didn't really get into musical theater until my early 20s after I moved to New York.
And I was reading on your website, you know, you've done all these tours and you've done these shows and things like, so what was the moment where the light switched on where you could get on stage instead of just in your basement? Because I'm pretty sure there's not enough room to invite a whole audience down there
yeah.
to watch before. So that's not effective.
but just a really quick kind of, I call it going off to Syracuse because I'll get off topic real quick, but I'll get back to your question. So I'm in the basement one day. I had to be about in seventh or eighth grade. And I think at the time I had just seen a production of Raisin at, there's a theater downtown in Connecticut called the Bushnell. That's where all the Broadway tours go. And we had gone on a school trip to see Raisin, the Raisin in the Sun musical.
Yeah.
And the little kid in the show sang a song called Sidewalk Tree. Man, I'd be singing that just at the top of my lungs in the basement, just going at it with that song. And I heard the doorbell ring, but it didn't dawn on me to stop singing. And so my mom was home and she answered the door. And later she told me that the post office, the mail guy, what do you call this? The postal mailman, Jesus.
Oh, man.
that guy. The mailman was like, oh my God, who's that singing in your house? And I had no idea that it never dawned on me that I would be singing so loudly some days. I'm in the basement thinking I'm all by myself and no one can hear me. People for years have probably been hearing me sing outside because the windows open, the house is open, so they could hear me. But anyway, that's that. But the moment I realized theater was it. Jesus. Okay, you know what? Okay. I'll try to make the story as concise as possible. So, so one of my first jobs while I was in design school, I was a waiter at a place called Bennigan's out on Long Island. And one of my favorite people to work with, she was a voice major at CW Post. And in order to get through our shifts, we'd be in the back just like singing duets as we're grabbing foods and taking it out to give to our guests. And she just one day said to me, you know, so you're a singer, right? And I was like, no, I'm not a singer. What are you talking about? And she says, no, you're a singer. And, you know, of course I fought her on it. She fought me on it. And she was as stubborn as I was. And so she started sort of going through all the trade papers. And one day she saw an audition for Finian's Rainbow. And she came into work and told me that she had seen this this audition and she thought I should go on it. I said no. She said yes. I said no. And next thing I know, I was at her house in front of a piano learning My Funny Valentine. And she told me, okay, whatever you do, just when you get in the room, if they ask you, what are you going to sing? Just tell them I'm going to sing My Funny Valentine in the key of C. And don't say anything else. Just smile. And so I walked in. They were like, so James, what are you going to sing? My Funny Valentine, key of C. And I had no idea how to read music. Didn't even know what the key of C was. And so I start singing this song and I see them back there smiling and I'm just going at it. And, you know, they thanked me and I walked away. And a couple days later, they called and offered me the role of Howard, the young scientist. And so I got cast in the show, did the show. And I don't think then I was necessarily thinking of it as a career because I didn't have any real training. Yeah. But then a few months, and by the way, at that time, I'd also dropped out of design school. I didn't tell my parents. So we were so me and my roommates were keeping it secret. Every time I'd call home on Sundays to talk to my parents, we just pretend that everything was cool and I'm going to school. And it was okay because at that point I was actually paying for school on my own. So they, you know, I just didn't want to disappoint them having already dropped out of school once before. So about 9 months after Finian's Rainbow, I ended up getting cast in a touring production of a show called Pearly. Yep. So I had to call my parents and siblings and tell them that their free-spirited youngest son, youngest brother, uncle type person was going out on tour with Pearly. And my mother's response was, what's a Pearly? And I'm not quite sure how I got out of that, but I do remember my father saying something to the effect, as long as he's happy and he's not hurting anybody else, let him find his way. Let him do what he needs to do. I was like 22 years old. And so I went out on the tour. And I think while I was out on that tour, I don't know, something just clicked. You know, I was literally going to all these cities. It was out in the Midwest. It wasn't even a fancy tour. It was non-union. We were literally on we were on one of those airport buses. We had to pack our own bus. We were sharing hotel rooms, but I was out on tour and, you know, I was doing my thing. And I think that by the time I got back to New York, I realized there was really something there. I had something to offer the industry. And that's when I really started to look at it as something that I should pursue seriously.
Well, and from, you know, you've gone on other tours. You mentioned that you were on a cruise ship with one of our other guests.
I did actually before the tour of Pearly. Let me backtrack a little bit. Cause it's so weird. Like my life has been just like all these roads that kind of intertwine. So when I got the Finian's Rainbow Dinner Theater show, I was working at a place called Bennigan's out on Long Island. And so I was literally traveling from Long Island into Manhattan out to Jersey to do the show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was a hike. Yeah. And so, and while I was doing the Finian's Rainbow show, I think we only had like three or four performances a week, because you know that they were lunch. It was for like the geriatric crowd. So we were doing this dinner theater for like all these old people having lunch. And so one day, two of my castmates, Cynthia and Roger, had heard about this cruise ship that had just started, this dinner cruise ship that had just started down at Pier 17. And they were like, well, you know, we're going to go down there after work, you know, an audition. They're having more auditions. You want to go? And I'm like, yeah, sure, let's go. Whatever. I know Funny Valentine in the KSC. Let's do this. So we go down there and I got real fancy on them because I had found sheet music for Satin Doll, and I knew it because I had been spent so many years in the basement singing Satin Doll from Sophisticated Ladies. But I didn't know, it didn't dawn on me until I got there, oh, this might be in a different key than I learned it in. And so, you know, so I get there and we give it to the music director. He starts playing, and thank God it was in the same key. I think I would have been okay anyway, because I have pretty good relative pitch, but you know, just in case it was too high or too low, you know, could get a little sketchy. But I sang, passed the audition, and they hired me. And so I started working on The Spirit of New York. And so while I wasn't part of the inaugural crew, a lot of people that remember me from there still remember me as part of the first season crew of the ship. And it was really cool. I mean, it was the hokiest, corniest musical review that we did. I mean, like, we did a musical theater version of The Pointer Sisters. It was so bad. But we thought we were doing something. And I was like, I was absolutely the worst waiter in the world. I don't drink. So I don't know one drink from the other. So when people would order drinks, I'd go to the bar and tell the bartenders, hey, do me a favor. I need you to put the drinks in the order I wrote them down. And say, you know, someone was sitting there with, you know, with curly hair and glasses. I would write curly hair glasses next to the starting point. And I knew, you know, go left. Yeah. And so I would go left from there and pray to God I was serving the right people the right drink. I mean, I knew what a pina colada looked like.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it was like a scotch and soda, I had no idea no clue. So going off to Syracuse again. So I, one day on the ship, I get the bright idea. I was on the third, we had three levels on the ship. And I was on the third level this day. And in order to get to the third level, we didn't have a sink and a kitchen up there. So we had to go to the second level to get all the water and drinks and everything. So I decide that I'm going to save myself a little time at the start of the cruise. And I was going to serve all my tables their water at once, because we had to give guests water when they came in. So I think I had probably about 20 glasses of water on this big tray. You know, this is not going to end well. So I go up the stairs, and as I go up, we're on the Hudson, you know, there are other ships and things going by, and so ships rock.
Mm-hmm.
And so just as I get to the top of the stairs, the ship leaves the dock and it starts to rock. And every glass of water on my tray fell off, broken glass water everywhere. And I just stood up and said, hi, I'm James, I'll be your waiter. And and they all looked at me like, oh my God, this is either gonna go really bad or this kid has a really fun personality and we're gonna have a good time. And so I gave them they had a good time. So yeah, I worked in The Spirit of New York, and I did that in between shows. And it was really cool because it gave us a chance to, you know, to sing and work out new material between auditions and between shows. You know, we always had you know, a platform to perform on, you know, to keep our instruments well-oiled. So it was a really cool job.
Nice. So let's talk about There Was a Boy, the mm-hmm. musical about Nat King Cole. What was the impetus to create that in the first place?
The impetus for that is that pretty much from the time I started performing professionally, and especially when I would do period shows, I'd walk on stage and people would tell me that I remind them of Nat King Cole. I knew who Nat King Cole was, but I didn't really know him. And so, you know, after hearing it quite a bit, I decided to start doing some research to find out who the man was. And to be honest with you, there wasn't a whole bunch of information available about him back then. So most of my research really was just, you know, raiding the albums in my parents' basement and, you know, listening to his music. Over time, more information did start to become available. And the more I learned about him, the more interested I became to know more about who he was behind the music. And over time, I just started taking notes down about little things I would learn about him, and I would put them on index cards and just save them for no particular reason. And after a few years, as in like a lot of few years, I finally, after 7 years or so, I'd finally started thinking about doing something. And initially, you know, I was thinking about a vanity project, something like a cabaret show. But then I was like, well, no, I don't want to do that, because I think, you know, I think his life is way more interesting than that, you know, just from, what I know about him. And so I started thinking in terms of writing a show about him, you know, a real book show. And so I called up one of my industry friends one day, and just someone I trusted that I didn't feel stupid asking her this question, you know, I'm thinking about doing the show about Nat King Cole. Do you think there's any merit to this? And she's like, well, sounds interesting, but what you got? And I pulled out a big stack of index cards. I said, I got these. And she was like, dude, that's your story right there. I was like, oh, okay. So really, it started out as people saying you look like Nat King Cole, and you know, me learning a few of his songs. But then it was really when I found out who he was behind the music that made me really interested to tell a story. And I was just surprised that no one had done much more really than, you know, do tribute shows with his biggest hits. I'm like, oh my God, like there's a real story there. Somebody should tell it. And, I guess no one else told it because it was waiting for me to tell it.
How long ago did this idea come to you? And then how much time till that first time got on stage?
I would say I really got serious about trying to write the story in the late 90s, around 98 and 99. Because around that time, for some reason, things were sort of... I don't even know what was going on in my life or in New York at that point, career-wise, but I just remember taking a particular interest in script writing around then, like really becoming interested. I think it was because there really weren't a lot of projects that I found interesting. And I got the bright idea, well, I'll just start writing stuff myself.
Yeah.
And so I think around 1999 and also around then, you know, the internet was starting to, you know, become... I guess more user friendly, and more information about him started showing up on the internet. Still not a lot, but a little bit. There at that point, there were also quite a few biographies out about him. And so, I've read so many biographies about his life. So it was really around then that I got serious about it. So from 1999 and, I'd never written anything before. And so, you know, it took me some time to figure, I'd been in shows before, but, you know, I didn't really know anything really about, you know, a writer's sense of play structure and drama and, you know, hills and valleys and all that stuff. And so I had to figure all that out. Also, I didn't know what the rules were about writing about someone who was famous. And I got so much misinformation. You know, there are a lot of people who think they're giving you good advice and they really don't know the rules. And so, you know, again, the internet, there was some stuff available. I couldn't afford a lawyer, like to really talk to anybody. So I had to, you know, I had to find stuff on my own. And that kind of research takes a long, long, long time. And so that's why it took me so long, because I had to find it out on my own. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time at the libraries, online, in books, going to bookstores, trying to find stuff, whatever. And so from 1999, I would say that's when I really got serious about wanting to put it down as a script. And then 2014 is the first time I presented the show. I produced a table read in Midtown Manhattan. It was very simple. One of my college friends, Doug Shapiro, we both looked into our network of friends and actors, and we got 15 people together. I pulled them inside of a studio in Midtown, and I didn't tell anybody what the script was about. They were kind enough to show up. I couldn't afford to pay them. They just showed up. And And I said, well, I can't afford to pay you, but I'll feed you. So I went down to Trader Joe's and I got a bunch of snacks and waters and juices and stuff. And I set up the tables in a room like a big Thanksgiving table. We all sat around and we read the script. And it wasn't until about five pages in, somebody just stopped and said, hang on, you wrote a script about Nat King Cole. I was like, yeah, I did. I forgot to tell you guys that. So yeah. So I guess about 14 or 15 years it took to, you know, get it from idea to actually getting it in front of people, like real people, and not just the people that the voices I can program on my writing program. So yeah,
I don't want to sound old, but kids nowadays don't understand how much, like, you had to read books, and that takes time. You can't just
like actual
Wikipedia,
books.
Like
yeah.
Like, I totally understand where you're coming from, where you got to do that. Yeah. And yeah, the time length it takes from concept to getting it out there.
So I will tell you though, you know, even though it took a long time, you know, there were obviously, you know, there's a lot of frustration and disappointment that happens when things, I always explain to people that, you know, sometimes the things we want in life, you know, we create these movies in our minds about how they're supposed to work out and the time in which they're supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And they don't always work out. You know, the movie in your head is not necessarily the movie that your life will put you in. And, you know, so that happened to me. And there were a lot of times that I wanted to give up. I just wanted to just throw in the towel and say, you know what, I'm done with this thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's one of those projects that for some reason, it kept choosing me and it kept pulling me back in. And, you know, it's just that, you know, eventually I realized, you know what, this project is not going anywhere until I actually tell the story. And so, you know, just stay the course and tell the story. So I'm sticking it out.
Very nice. Congratulations on getting it to where it is. And so has it had a production of some kind? And how did that go?
Yeah, we have actually. We've had a few, there's been a few different cycles of development. Let's see. Where do I start? Because I can go all over the map with this. So in 2014 we did the stage reading, or rather the table read. Mm-hmm. 2015, I was at home in Connecticut. One of my high school mentors passed away, and my cousin Vincent, she was also his mentor, and so we were at her funeral. And you know, Vincent, Ben and I are the same age, and we hadn't seen each other for a while. And so, you know, we were kind of like connecting. I was telling him about this Nat King Cole project I wrote. And he said, Nat King Cole? I was like, yeah. He said, would you be interested in coming down to my university and doing a workshop of it? I was like, yeah, sure. And kind of embarrassed to say that even though, you know, he's my cousin, I didn't really know what he was doing at the university. I knew he worked down there and I knew he was a fantastic singer, great opera singer, but I had no idea what the heck he did down there. So as it turns out, he was the director of the school's opera studies program. And so they pulled together a small grant and brought me down for a month. And the summer before I went to Baltimore, I collaborated with another longtime friend, Matt Falker. He lives out in California. I'd met him during my California days. I call him the mad scientist of music. So Matt, if you're listening, mad scientist of music. He collaborated with me and arranged all the musical numbers. And Matt is an absolutely brilliant arranger. You know, jazz is his thing. And I mean, just the things he did. And we did it all long distance, which was really cool. So we get to Baltimore, spend 4 weeks down there as part of the opera workshop class on campus. And for the kids to participate in the show, and the show was part of the curriculum for all the students who registered for the class that semester. The 4 weeks of rehearsals culminated with four performances of the show with a live band in front of an audience. We did some talkbacks with the audience because, you know, I wanted to get a sense of what was good, what was bad, and what was otherwise. and my desire to continue developing the script, the story, the music, et cetera. The feedback was overall positive. The show was a huge success. We played to full houses for the entire run. And I got invited to come back the following year to do a full-scale workshop of the show.
Oh, wow.
So the school pulled together enough money to bring me down for the entire semester. And my show actually became the full opera workshop class. Wow. And so through grants and donations, you know, they made all that possible. Unlike the year before, though, you know, again, we had, you know, I had a set designer, I had costumes, props, all the bells and whistles that came, you know, that come with a full scale production. You know, they weren't fancy, you know, it's a college production. So it was really cool. It was rather limited. And again, the show was a really big success. We played to full houses almost the entire time. And it was a great experience. And then a month after that, after Baltimore, I flew out to San Diego to do a staged reading of the show at MiraCosta College, which is where my friend Matt teaches.
Wow.
We did the reading with a 40 member chorus of singers and actors out there, live band made up of all students. Again, the show was a huge success, but the difference this time is that unlike Baltimore, where the audience was predominantly Black African-American, in San Diego, that's the neighboring county. In San Diego, though, the audience was predominantly white.
Hmm.
But then something super cool happened. And that is that we got the same emotional response from the audience that we, from the white audience that we did from the Black audience. Yeah. And that, I have to say, is the moment that I realized that this show really was something special and that it spoke to everybody. I always wanted to write, my goal was always to write something that spoke to everybody, regardless of age, demographic, race, religion, whatever. And so that little test sort of proved to me that it did. And so after that, I spent the next few years developing the script further, attending pitch meetings with industry people to get used to the idea of pitching the show so that when the time comes to fundraise, I will be better prepared I'll be better prepared in knowing what to do and what to say in those meetings to get people interested and get them on board. And so then fast forward to 2019, I got the bright idea to do a full-on concert, a fundraising concert in my hometown. So I take my own show on the road and I go back to Connecticut and go into the university auditorium.
Not in the basement? Hartford.
No, not the basement.
Okay, good. Okay.
And here's the funny thing. There were so many people, you know, people over the years have figured out that, you know, now James Ritz sings.
Yeah.
But what's so funny is that a lot of them, they were like, he sings? We didn't even know he could talk. And because I just didn't talk. So we go back. I go back. I take my band. I got some excellent musicians from New York to go back with me. And I mean, like these guys, are guys I've gigged with for years in New York. And I mean, these are like guys, like they're seriously at the top of their game in the industry. And they agreed to do this because they're my friends. And they said, you know, we're gonna do a favor. I mean, of course I paid them, but you know, they didn't charge me their normal fees, which I couldn't afford it. So they came to Connecticut. We did the concert. Huge, 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 tremendous, ridiculous success. About that night, I didn't sell enough tickets to make the money I was trying to raise to put on a professional union staged reading, which was gonna be my next cycle of development. But what happened is exactly 2 months to the date of the concert, two investors who had been at the show, and I kind of knew them both through other people came forward and said, I want to give you half and I want to give you half. And so I raised all the money I needed for the reading 2 months after the show. And so get back to New York, call up my creative team and say, hey guys, guess what? We got some money. And so we make all these plans to do the reading. And so we had set a date for, I think it was going to be April 18th, 2020. And you know where this is going.
Yep.
Show was all cast. Rehearsal space was all confirmed. We had a great off-Broadway theater space reserved. It's Theater 315 on West 47th Street. Great, it's a beautiful space. I was so excited to be in there. I had, a killer, like a world-class band put together to play the music.
Yeah.
Had all the moving parts in place. Within a week of opening up the RSVP list, the two performances that we had that we had scheduled were almost completely full. Mm-hmm. So that meant that my first showing of this show in New York was going to be a full house. I mean, that's like crazy.
Yeah.
And then.
Yep.
I hate to say this word, but COVID-19 came to town and shut everything down with less than 2 weeks before our presentation date. And needless to say, that sent everything into a tailspin for me. I went into a really dark place that lasted for just like a good minute. Cause I mean, I had spent so much time preparing for like this, this is gonna be my moment to finally like get like these people, these relationships I've been cultivating with these industry people to get them out to finally see my show. And it all got shut down by this freaking COVID-19 thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it just being in that dark space, it didn't help me that, you know, that here in New York, you know, we were basically like, I guess like everywhere else, we were locked inside our apartments, you know, we were on house lockdown and, you know, being by yourself in a house with my dog, but he couldn't talk to me. You know, man, that was some rough going for me. But then slowly but surely, I came out of the funk, as I always do. And, you know, I started finding ways to be productive with my project and my creativity. And after I got over the shock of everything falling apart the way it did, I regrouped and brainstormed a path forward. And I was completely against this whole virtual theater thing. I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm just not doing it. But, you know, after giving it some real thought and, you know, coming to my senses, I figured out something that would work for James Rich as far as presenting something virtually. And so I put together a plan for a virtual staged reading my way and presented it. I did a formal presentation to my creative team, as in the director and the music director, and they were on board for it. And so we settled on, on a date to capture the concert in the spring of 2021. And then in the middle of everything falling into place, my entire world fell apart. I got a call from my sister 3 days after my birthday telling me that my father passed away at home. And oh my God, man, that just, I'm still angry about that. But I'm finding a way through that. And I knew that he wouldn't have wanted me to stop doing what I love to do. Oh my God, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Oh my God, I knew I shouldn't have brought him up. But anyway, you know, I hit the pause button on everything and I went to Connecticut to be with my family and spent some time with them. And after I got back to New York, I knew that it was best to keep myself busy with the show so that I wouldn't fall into another dark place.
For sure.
So I unpaused the button and we continued to move forward with the virtual reading. And I am happy to say that we completed capturing all of the content for a proof of concept virtual reading a couple months ago. We are sort of in a state of post-production editing hell right now. but I will say that what I've seen of the footage, you know, it's not perfect, but man, I tell you, I'm so happy with the end result. And I'm hoping that sometime in the next month or so, we will actually be able to present I'll be able to host an invite only virtual presentation of the show. So keep your eyes and ears open.
Very nice. Well, congratulations on getting through everything. It's not been, I've talked to so many people during my interviews and, you know, the last year, the pandemic has been the
nightmare.
It's been, unfortunately, the focal point of all of our conversation. And I'm looking forward to now that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, we're going to look at it and go, you know what, that's in the past. We're going to move forward. So
yeah,
congratulations on pushing through.
Thank you so much.
That went on. But honestly, what else are you going to do? Right. You got to moving forward.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, as you said, the movie that you set out for doesn't always follow.
It does not materialize the way you thought it was going to play out. It just doesn't. But
so is there anything else in that's going on with you, James? You got any projects in the go outside of this, or is this your focal point right now?
It is my focal point, but in December, I will actually be not really in your neck of the wood, but on your side of the
border.
International border. Yes. Okay. I will be heading up to British Columbia.
Yes.
To headline a Christmas concert called Home for the Holidays, a Nat King Cole Christmas. The dates are December 5th through 11th. It'll be if I'm repeating myself, I'm sorry, I kind of have brain farts that way sometimes. It'll be a 7-city tour. And I'm really excited because it'll be my first time on a real stage in front of like real people, singing songs with like a real band and stuff. And so I can't wait to get there. I'm so looking forward to it. I've had a few production meetings with the producer and the band and, you know, and all the creative team. Mm-hmm. Just the nicest team, and I think it's going to be something special. So, you know, if you're going to be out there, you, anybody else, or if you know somebody that's out there, come on out and be a part of it.
BC is gorgeous. You're gonna love it if you haven't been out there. And it's 4,000 kilometers, so what, 3,000 miles away? Well, it's California, right?
Yeah exactly. Yeah,
I'm not that close. As much as I'd love to go see you out there, and I don't think
I don't happen. Okay.
Well, James, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about yourself, the Nat King Cole musical that you've been writing, and everything else that's going on. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Well, before we go, I always like to ask three questions of my guests to get to know them a little bit better than what we have. Okay. There's no right or wrong answers, though the last one might have a wrong answer. So we're going to be too long. So question number one. What creator or team within musical theater has had a great influence on you? You know, it could be a composer, a lyricist, director, producer, actor, stage manager even. It could be somebody famous, non-famous, like a teacher. Is there anybody in the community that's had a good effect on you?
Oh, man. so many people. I think the best response for me though to this particular question would be that I'd have to say that it's more about fanboying over certain shows as opposed to the creatives behind the production, and in particular shows that have some historical value and that manage to educate as well as entertain us. Those really resonate with me. That being said, three shows that I would have to say really had a direct influence on my Nat King Cole show and what I want to do in the future, you know, the quality of the kinds of shows I want to create are shows like Dreamgirls by Tom Ian and Henry Kreiker on music, Beautiful, the Carole King musical, Doug McGrath on the book, Carole King obviously on the music, and a little show that a lot of people don't know about, Sideshow. Bill Russell on book, Henry Kreiger again on music. I was fortunate to see all of those shows live. And to me, they all told dynamic stories. They educated us, gave us some history, and they were incredible and memorable bodies of music and theater that define what Broadway magic means to me.
Nice. Correct answer. There's no wrong answer. So 1 point. Fantastic. Okay. Question number two. Now, I read that you toured with Harry Belafonte as a backup singer.
I did.
And you've written a show about Nat King Cole. So you really have a thing for singers that were big in the 50s. Now, is there another performer from that decade that you'd love to have worked with or have an affinity for?
Oh, my God. Okay, there are so many people that will tell you I am a Sarah Vaughan junkie. I have loved Miss Sarah Vaughan, Miss Sassy Vaughan since like forever and a day. In fact, when I did the tour of Pearly, you know, this was back in the day of, you know, we didn't have CD players, we didn't have, you know, digital things on phones. Yeah. We had cassette tapes, and so I had a little cassette player in my cassette tape, and my earphones broke, and I wasn't making enough money to buy a new set. So in my hotel room with my roommates around, I'd fall asleep with Sarah Vaughan in my ear. I took all my Sarah Vaughan cassette tapes. And I literally have just like the most ridiculous collection of her music. But if I could have met her or performed with her, that would have been just like, oh, the cat's meow for me. But I got her music and I got a lot of videos of her. And so I have that. So I'm happy about that.
Nice. Correct answer. Not that you would have said a wrong answer, but it's the answer. So 2 points. Last question. This is the one that we're going to learn more about you. Food in the theater or cell phones in the theater? Which is worse?
Oh, man. Okay. I'm sure you've gotten this before. They both are just terrible ideas. But definitely for me, cell phones. Okay. They are so distracting. They pull way too much focus. And especially for performers. Everybody listening, please do not ever have a cell phone and leave it on in a theater. It's so distraction. It just takes away from us being honest with our work. And the honesty of being in the moment is where the magic of live theater lives, not only for a performer, but also for you. So put the phone, just turn it off, put it away, and you know, pay attention. But right, definitely cell phones.
Both are worse. You got it right the first time.
So I couldn't really say food because I worked in dinner theater a couple of times and on the dinner cruise ship. So yeah. I've been around food and clinking plates and stuff like that. So I'm like, that I can deal with.
That's a different beast though, right?
You, yeah, true.
As an actor, you know they're going to be chewing.
You do. Right. Yeah,
that's true. A whole thing. That's
true.
That's
true.
But, so 3 out of 3 correct answers. No, I have no problem.
Yay!
But you got it perfect. James, thank you again so much for coming on and telling us a little bit about yourself and your projects.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's just such a pleasure to meet you. And I have to remember to call my friend and tell her thank you for introducing us.
No problem. All right. We were just speaking with James Rich, the creator of the musical There Was a Boy. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion. That is musical theater. I'm your host, as always, Jean-Paul Jovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.